Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Who Am I This Time? With me, David Morrissey. Each episode, I'm talking to performers from film, television and theatre about one significant role in their career. It might not always be the role they're most famous for, but in each one, I'll be trying to find out about the preparation, the excitement, and the sense of nostalgia that goes with any key role in an actor's lifetime. Award-winning British actress Anna Friel burst onto our screens with her portrayal of Beth Jordash in Channel 4's hard-hitting soap, Brookside. Despite initial nervousness about leaving the show, she has subsequently starred in challenging TV, film, and theatre roles, not just here in the UK, but also in the US. Since 2016, Anna has played the title role in the British Nordic noir detective series Marcella. In 2017, she won the International Emmy Award for Best Actress for her performance. I caught up with her earlier this year, ahead of the launch of the third season, to talk about the challenges of playing the character. Hello and welcome to Who Am I This Time? My guest this week is the wonderful Anna Friel, and we'll be talking about Marcella from the wonderful show Marcella. So I just wanted to talk to you about, because is it true that when Hans Rosenfeld sort of approached you to play the role, you thought, I don't know whether I want to do this. Did you pull out or something?
I think it was about 6 weeks before we were about to start. I was with my director and I had a few wobbles and said, I don't know what I can offer differently. There's too many people who have done it so well, and I think you might have the wrong person. And he completely disagreed and said, just stick with me for a little bit and let's work through it. And he said, I think we should make her a rock and roll kind of cop. And that kind of caught my attention. He said, give her a funny walk and she's a bit androgynous. And he said, let's just take your attitude of life to her attitude to work. So he convinced me. I think it's just like with any job, when you start, you have nerves. And it's the older I've got, the more I've realised the more prep you do, the better you're going to be. Mm-hmm. And I was worried if I didn't have enough time to prep, but I did. And I worked really hard. And as soon as day one of shoot came, I felt ready.
Also, there is that thing of how do I make this difference, isn't there? You know, I mean, and you've really achieved that. But we see cop shows a lot, but there's something, I mean, obviously there's some sort of Scandi drama. They talk about Scandi noir, but you've really brought something different to it. Where was your starting point about making her different?
Well, it was written in Swedish, so that it is really Scandi noir. It's the first time that was done, but setting it in London and then translating it to English language. So the writing makes it different just to start with. And he said, I'm not quite sure who she is, but that's your job, Anna. And you've got room to breathe. And it was a lot about how she moved, how she walked, the fact that she wears a parka. There's a little bit of Oasis going on there, to be honest. and the way she dressed, she'd just been left by a man, so sexuality and openness wasn't really on the agenda, but it was to give her a key look and a style that was unique to her without it being overtly sexual. And that was also, again, about her movement and not ever using her feminine qualities to get what she wanted. It was the opposite of that, but yet still giving her some kind of cool.
She was a mum, or she is a mum.
And she is a mum, yeah.
Yeah. And she'd been out of the profession for a while, hadn't she? That was what I found in the first season really interesting, was she was somebody going back into a job that she hadn't been into for a while.
Yeah, I think she got bored of being the housewife. I think she was convinced into being that. And then without realising it, she was quite emotionally bullied at home and felt that she was worthless. So I think the chance to go back was very exciting for her. Because we're going back 5 years.
I know, and that's what I want to talk to you a little bit about, the difference between going through the seasons. But, you know, you've really laid the groundwork for this character that you spent a long time with. So where does your research start with a character? Do you go and meet coppers? Do you go and try and find her outside in the outside world?
At the beginning, most of it was about spending time with the creator, Nicola Larder, and Hans, and trying to get into their heads, which is always the best thing, is to get into the head of the writer. And then we had a really, really cool director who loves his music, and he wanted to create a sound theme for her. So I work a lot, I don't know about you, but I work a lot with music. I find it helps me concentrate and focus and set the tone for everybody else around. Often we'll have music playing on set. But first of all, with Charles Martin, it was like, let's give her what does she listen to? And rather than doing big backstories, there was enough backstory there. It was just, let's get on with the job. And I went to the police station for about 4 or 5 days and saw, I'm a stickler for wanting to get things right. But unfortunately with drama, you have to push the boundaries a little bit to make it indeed dramatic. And I was quite shocked at the police station. There was literally these poor guys who worked so hard getting their lunchbox out, and they were all so tightly sealed. And they said, because there's so many mice and rats in the building. Yeah. And so incredibly unglamorous it was. And incredibly dedicated they are. And I thought it was quite a responsibility on my shoulders to represent them in the truest and best way I could without sounding over earnest.
But was there one specific person who you sort of latched onto at all, or was it an amalgam of different sort of information coming at you?
They wanted me to meet various people. There was an advisor that took us all the way through and help and work with Hans to make sure that it was correct. But I remember being at the Groucho Club, for those of you who don't know that, it's a members club in London, and you have to be a creative to be a member. And there was a woman who came to meet me, and I swear if you'd have looked at the table, you'd have thought that she was the actress. She was so glamorous with long, flowing blonde hair and bright red lips, and I kind of just come off set looking much like I do now, with my hair tied back and a sweatshirt. And said, wow, gosh, that's not what I expected. And she said, why not? And she said, I actually had the most successful cases last year compared to all the men. So I think she embodied me with confidence and saying, but if you're slight and small, how can anyone find you the right level of intimidating? And she was a really brilliant help. She told me how being a woman in the profession actually benefited her, and also the trials and tribulations that she came across early on in her career until she was taken seriously. So she was a big confidence boost for me. But I walked away still saying, I still don't want to wear red lipstick or have long flowing hair.
But physically, there's a lot of, I mean, God, you go through it, don't you? And the whole three seasons, you really put yourself out there. And I was just wondering about how you, in a long TV show, how you protect yourself, just your energy, because also, you know,
having to come home and not be a schizophrenic.
Yeah, but, I mean, all those things. How do you have a routine about that, or do you just go for it?
No, I'm very specific. I think as I've got older, that's, again, not to go, but all about prep, and you try and get in the best physical shape you can, just because you know the toll it's going to take on your body when you're doing 15 hours a day and for 5.5 months. I also, I live in Windsor, so I spent 4 hours a day in the car. Damn M4, damn government, damn motorhomes. So that was my prep time in the car with music and having my coffee and waking up and going over my lines. And then on the way back, it was learning the lines for the next day so that I'd have a bit of time when I got home with Gracie. But nobody shied away. Nicola, Charles, the director, Anne Hans was, we need you to go there. And they also start, they gave such intrigue, and I don't know if this is done before, but they didn't tell any of us, and they wouldn't show us the last three scripts of who actually was the killer. So there was almost a really intrigue and an interesting paranoia in the green room. And we'd all hang together because we'd be going, so is it me? I was convinced it was my channel. So I played it as if she was completely guilty, and I hoped it was going to be her. It was going to be the anti-hero. And swear to God, I didn't know until we read the second to last episode, and was like, ah, okay.
But also, that's in that first season, I think that is something that's really different, is that she has these blackout episodes. She's slightly out of control. She doesn't know. She's emotionally very out of control.
Yeah.
And can I just ask you about specifically those scenes where you, on a day yeah. where you have to lose it?
You know? It's called associated fugue attacks, and I'd never heard about that before. And I can't say who it was, but there was someone very close involved that had actually suffered from fugues themselves. So I had a direct contact and understanding of what that was. And she said, just imagine the worst ever hangover that you've got, and you can't remember what happened the night before, and you pick your phone up going, oh my God, who did I text? Why was I so? She said, take that and times it by 50, and you're somewhere close to what a fugue is. And then explain to me about how many criminals or people in jail there are that have actually committed crimes whilst they're having a fugue and have no recollection of it. Again, it was all about complete and utter focus for those scenes. I had to go to the dark place. I didn't smile very much in 5.5 months without sounding woe me. It's so hard. It's my job that I love, but as soon as the concentration goes, it's not there. So I spent a lot of my time not smiling and being in a corner. I remember, if it helps explain better, in season two, where because we shoot a lot on the underpass in Earls Court, and it was a really beautiful, happy day, and the sky was blue, and I was kind of skipping, going, I've got this, it's season two, I know what I'm doing, I can get into that world. And I go onto the underpass, and I normally take about an average one to three takes, and he pulled me aside, the director, Jonathan, and just said, Hannah, what's going on? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, where is she? She's not here, as in Marcella. And I said, I don't know, is she not? He said, nope. He said, you're too happy. And he said, go in the corner. Ugh, and I did, and I put my headphones in, and I listened to, I think I listened to a lot of Hannah Zimmer through that, and thought my dark thoughts, which now not so much, but it was always about my father. I'd always think about loss, and I used to carry a green book with me everywhere, actually. And I think that was season one that David Grace's daddy had written to me. And I think it took me many years to realise the gravitas of that I could pick it up, and the importance of any single page. And if I needed to feel sadness and cry immediately, or I needed to miss or long, I'd be able to go to any page of that book. And I carried around like a Bible, and it was just immediate. I've stopped doing that, and I've stopped thinking morbid thoughts about my father as he's got older. I have to use different tools, and I think, yeah, it might look like you've not got over a relationship if you're still walking around with the green book, but no one knew what it was. I'm just telling you, you've worked with him, you'll know that he's a really phenomenal writer. And it's all about triggers, isn't it? There's things that can and focus, and nothing else can get in. And you do, to a certain degree, become her for the day, but not, you know, as long as you can remember when you get home, you leave it at work. Otherwise, I would basically traumatize my child, which I have no intention of doing.
Yeah, I mean, I use music a lot. I mean, I'll do two playlists. One, I'll do a playlist for mood music, which, you know, will get me in and out of where I need to be. But I also do a playlist of the characters' music, who I think the music that they would like to listen to, which is sometimes quite different to mine.
I do exactly the same. Can we work together again soon?
But I also, I've started using photographs a lot. So I will tell, and what I used to do is do a lot of writing in a book. Yeah. And now what I do is a mood book of photographs, and just sort of, I can with the music, I can just look at them and then I can get into a certain place and move into the mood I need.
And it's fascinating, isn't it? Because sometimes the playlist for your character is so different. It wouldn't necessarily, that I'm working, I'm training now ready for my next role. The playlist is nothing that I would listen to. It's quite heavy metal and stuff that actually annoys me. But I'm like, oh, that's going to be the last thing I want to listen to at 5:30 a.m. But it's going to give that kind of, she's a bit erratic and tougher, and it's when I'm not working the emotional parts, but when she's got to be the strongest version of her, my playlist will be totally different. But I find classical music such as Hans Zimmer, and it's they're so connected, music and drama, aren't they? And it just emotes any feeling. You can just be wherever you need to be within 2 minutes, so you're not holding people up.
And sometimes you, like you were saying before, I can use one piece of music and then suddenly it just stops working for some reason. I don't know what it is, or, you know, whatever I used to use isn't working anymore. And I have to surprise myself in a different way to get myself into with a different piece of music or a different piece of writing or something like that.
Yeah, or physicality. You'll have to, I'm really physical on set. It'd be a bugbear of mine. Sometimes I'm a little bit OCD, and I can see that a director just said an action, and you know that their heart rate isn't right, and they might not be flushed enough. So I always say, just give me 2 or 3 minutes, and I'm doing press ups, or I'm jumping up and down. I'm really, really physical, and also I exhaust my arms, because it was pointed out to me by two ex-boyfriends actually. We both happen to be actors, but particularly David. He said, "What is it with you and your arms?" And no one had ever pointed that out to me. It's so simple. If I go back to someone, which none of us ever want to do, go back to 18 and just go, oh my God, it's so bad. But my arms would look like they're flying. So I had to go do an exercise of tying, and it was a way of getting energy out. And I was absolutely unaware of that. And so the only way around that I found was to just do so many press-ups as many as my little body could carry. And so they were so tired, they'd limp. And then that did something different, because it would change the place of where the voice comes from and how the shoulders stand. And then I started to work out how all of those things had worked hand in hand and beautifully symbiotically. I was quite thrilled about Andy Serkis and Theatre de Complicité. I'd love to have had the chance to do that and work with movement. I'm going to work with a movement coach just for a day for the next role, because I'm too much is kind of left on my shoulders right now. And I thought, I heard an actress recently had worked with a movement coach. Have you heard the story? I don't know if it's true, but the girl who plays Princess Diana in the new series, I think she's called Emma, she worked with a movement coach and studied a shy cat.
Wow.
So which I don't know whether that's true, but I just thought, that's really clever, because if you're playing someone that exists, instead of doing an impersonation, you're studying the movement of what they are, so it's not, you're not then held and stuck to certain imagery.
Yes, I've used movement coaches in the past.
And
sometimes it's things from nature, it will be animals or whatever, but sometimes it's an amalgamation of different sort of energies and sort of postural sort of how you hold yourselves and stuff like that. Yeah, it's really interesting.
Is it? I can't wait for that. I think because I missed out on drama school, I missed all those bits when you have to pretend to be a tortoise for 5 days. I was like, what would I have probably chosen? A sloth, so I could get away with it as possible.
I've done that thing also where sometimes I will, just in a rehearsal or whatever, I will wear shoes which are too small for me, or
yes.
I will do things that I'll put ankle weights on, or I'll wear you can get these like heavy vests that people use when they're working out. I will do a whole rehearsal in a vest.
That's right.
In a weighted vest and stuff.
Because you're good. That's not the good thing for me.
But it's also tricks. I mean, they're tricks to get me. They're not tricks, but they're sort of methods of getting me into a different place that I need to get to.
Yeah.
And they're really effective, I think.
I do too.
But you can, in a long TV show, you know, for me, sometimes I can forget and I have to remind myself.
Oh, God, not with Marcelli, you've not got a chance to forget, believe me.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because you're so front and center of it, obviously, all the time. I mean, do you have, going into something like season three, which is quite different, isn't it, season three? But going into it, do you have to do, before you go into it, do you have to do a reminder sort of little couple of weeks where you're getting back into her?
Oh, my God. Yeah, there was more to it than just a few reminders. A, it had been a long time. Mm-hmm. Also, for the third season, we only had Hans Rosenfeld for the first two episodes. And you know how important the writing is. It's everything. And often, yeah, as actors, we're tweaking and going, oh, but it's not Hans, and they don't know if they understand the show. And I was executive producing on that one as well. And was a little bit discombobulated thinking I've got nothing that feels safe. I've got none of the cast around me. We're working in Ireland, not London. There's no police station. I'm in a blonde wig, which has been scarred. We were shooting so out of sequence. So I had to do so many kind of story arcs and storyboards to remind me exactly where I was. Because I don't know if people who are listening know that most things are not shot in sequence. And I think that's probably the biggest challenge for any of us who do long running series, is that, say, episode one or season one or season two, we did in three blocks. So episode 1 to 3, and then 4, 5, 6, and then 7 and 8. So once you finish the three, you forget about them. With season three, we did episodes 1 and 2, and then the next was done as a block of 5. And when you're tracking it, you've only seen the first two episodes, but if you see where it goes, there's lots of twists and turns. And to shoot, going on the morning and shoot episode 4, scene 12, and then in the evening you're doing episode 7, scene 16. So you've either got to undo knowledge or jump forward. So you have to track all of it, which is, I think, why we're not being demanding, but we're saying if you want the best performances out of us, rather than just sending us a great pilot episode 1, can you send us the whole series so we can study the arc and the movement? Because very rarely do we shoot in sequence.
So do you have a Bible that is next to your script? Do you have like a storyboard, a sort of timeline Bible?
Yeah, I take a whiteboard in my trailer. I'll tell you about my trailer in a minute because it's quite funny. Especially in these times of COVID, I was like, see, I wasn't being demanding. I was ahead of the times. Remind me to talk to you about that. It's quite funny. But anyway, in it, I have a big whiteboard. And so for every day, I'll say, right, you've done that. And I'll think about, erase that. So don't concentrate on that because that's not happened yet. Being a true Cancerian, I make that my cozy place. It's like my shell. I fill it with fairy lights and we'll put words of the day and I can make my juices. And the last season, because we were so far away from any coffee shop, I bought a really good coffee machine. So my trailer became the coffee shop for everybody. Obviously, au gratuit.
That is fantastic. But can I just ask you about the continuity-wise of telling a story out of order? Mm-hmm. Because we do get scripts, I mean, you know, just by the nature, we get scripts quite late sometimes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I will have, like you said before, episodes 1 and 2, and I don't really know what's happening in 3 and 4. And I try to get involved with writers. Are you asking before you start on season 3, do you have at least a beat sheet of what's happening in the season?
Well, yes and no, because you don't want to get on their nerves, because unfortunately sometimes you can ask them and the answer is they don't know. And you wish they did and they hope they did. So sometimes you can steer them and say, well, is it this? Is it moving in this direction? And sometimes it depends on an ego, are really happy to listen and think, okay, you've got a point that it could go in that direction. And other times they say, no, it's very strict. Hans would always have a plan because of the plot of who did it. And we would, me and Nicola Lardo, the creator, would always say, but now we need to Marcella it up. That's what we'd say. So, because they'd always say, you make such odd choices. You could just, even if it was, I'd like to order a cup of tea and a slice of Marmite toast. It wouldn't just be in that vein. It'd be something I'd do a different, always make a different choice, because I thought what made her intriguing was her Let me find the right, her unpredictability.
Yeah, I love the fact that you never know where you are with her.
Yeah, and I try to do that all the time. And what's the oddest thing that we could do? So in season three, they showed me this bedroom, and there was a huge mansion we were working in. And they'd walk to the bedroom, and I said, this doesn't feel Kira or Marcella, because I was playing two characters in this. And he says, what do you mean? I said, well, it's just so bland. There was a place where she's meant to have a hiding place. And you think, don't put it behind the cupboard, because everyone always puts whatever they've got to find behind the cupboard. You know, it's a bit obvious. And about where she'd sleep. So I looked around the room and I said, I thought, oh God, I think I'm crazy. I said, I don't think she'd sleep on the four-post bed. I think she'd find that quite scary. I think she'd sleep under the table. He's like, why? I said, because it's small and it's womb-like and it's where she can hide from everyone. And when she can lock the door, no one can see. And that became a bit of a symbol. So things went from there. And every day there'd be things like that. I'd walk around the house going, oh, she'd love that. And it's funny when you start to think about it in the third person, not as yourself.
And when you have... In long series, we have different directors, don't we, sometimes for each episode?
Yeah.
How do you cope with that? Because what do you need from a director for you to be able to create? What are you looking for a director who's coming in, not the showrunner, but an episodic director? What are you looking for from them so that you can do what you need to do?
I always miss the first, and I always feel a sense of guilt when the second one comes on, and particularly if you've got on with the first one and you're there. Little protege and they think that they come on and say, well, how's the second one doing? How is it? And you go, oh, they're fine. I mean, obviously I really miss you. I never want to be disingenuous, but with the third, I really did on season three, I wouldn't say fall in love, but I admired him so much. And he's a French. I don't know if you've ever worked with him, called Gilles Bagny.
I thought he was great. I mean, I've only seen those two, so, and I thought it was beautifully directed.
Well, it's his ideas as well. He's shown me a lot of old kind of French, not horror, but French thrillers in the 70s and the use of the colour orange. And so let's make the mansion itself a character. And we would just, you know, I think directors forget, it's not that we need our little head stroking and our ego rubbed all the time, but just if you're filled with confidence, because often we can go and say, I can't, I won't be able to, what I can't. And they just go, Anna, you are Anna, it is amazing. And you then just go, okay, what more do you want? I'll give you everything. Then he did that. But then the next one, Ashley, I'd suggested I'd work with him Broken, on Jimmy McGovern's Broken.
Oh, which was fantastic.
Thank you. And I thought Ashley was great, and they didn't know which director. And I really fought for him because he's also a great writer. He works with music and we get on very well, because it's nice to have just that familiarity, because so much work goes into getting to know someone and for them to get to know you. And I think when you're younger, there's more of a pleasure and an excitement in that, much like when you go off to shoot on location. It's like, yeah, which country am I going to discover? But now at this age, you think, oh, another really lonely, cold hotel, and I'm just going to go back on my own and miss my family, and no one's going to hug me, without sounding too negative, not talking myself out of jobs. But things change, your values change very, very much, don't they, when you get older?
They do, but also I think we're able to ask for things that we know we're going to need down the line. As a younger actor, I didn't know I was going to need something, you know, in a month's time. I just was blindly walking into the job, and I've got to know myself better and how I work better. So, and I'm not shy of saying to someone, look, I know it sounds crazy to you, but I'm really going to need this type of place to live. I'm going to need this type of place to be. I'm going to need, so if you could, you've got to ask for those things, haven't you?
Yeah, but you still feel like, are you allowed to say arsehole?
Yes, we can say arsehole. Funny enough, that's been said a lot on this podcast.
I'm going to say, you do feel like an arsehole still asking for those things. And it's like, look, I'm not, because I'm needy or I'm really demanding and I don't need pink or blue M&Ms specifically. Just feed me. Can I have something that's healthy just to keep the energy levels up? And then that you understand that as you, that the set meals, sometimes the stodge is really comforting, but if they want you to be looking good, that you have to be fed. And if you've worked a lot in America, they'll come around with little juice shots and things that keep the crew going and the vital vitamins that we need for the day. So now I just kind of bring my own packed lunches and my own shakes in the morning and monitor that as I go. But you're right. So just somewhere nice to go at the end of a day that feels a little bit homey or comforting. Also, you can have your family to come and visit you. So for me, Gracie has always lived with me. And until, so I was in England for only 4 weeks last year, and she came with me on, she moved school for Marcella. She went to an all girls school called Strathern. We were there for 5 months. And when we got back, we went to Madison, Georgia, because that fell over the summer holidays. And then I left her to go and do a job in Nova Scotia. And she, when we got back, she said, "Mama, did you realize that was the last trip? I can't do it anymore." And she said, because she's doing the International Baccalaureate, and she just can't afford to miss the time and the curriculum. And she also wants to be with her friends. And I think it's been great for her up until now to know how nomadic life is and to get used to change and learn about all these different countries. But I'm the next job I'm going to, I'm like, without Gracie. And that would always, I know that sounds like a needy mommy, but it would just be such a grounding thing that you finish a day's work and I get home and could just go and wrap my arms around her or her around me. That means everything, doesn't it?
It's very important. It's very, and it's a really difficult balance to strike, but it's the balance that we strike, and it's one of the problems of success. But I mean, it's no less a problem, you know.
And it's so hard for relationships. I used to think about Tim Robbins and Susan Sarandon. Thinking they're the couple. So look, they did it. If they can do it, we can do it. And even they broke up. And look at the history of it. Of actors seem to only meet actresses and vice versa.
Yeah.
And it's the time apart. I remember David and I having 6 months when we didn't see each other. And your look often changes and you think, who are you? And I remember with Reese and I put it in our contracts that we weren't allowed to have more than 2 or 3 weeks apart at any given time, because it's just unsustainable. And you're so driven by your work. You realize, particularly with this lockdown for me, it's the first time I've ever stopped for this long. And really, really resetting and reevaluating what's been my driving force. How much have I given as much to my relationship as I have my work? I know I have with my child, because she's always been there. And they do need work and time just as much as your job does.
Yeah, lockdown's been really interesting for me, because I have been working on and off, but I've not felt guilty about not doing anything, because I know I'm not taking that personally. I know that nobody else is not working. It's not that my agent isn't working for me or the phone's not ringing for me. It's not ringing for anybody. So it's given me this sort of sense. I've relaxed a little bit more than I usually do.
Yeah, I think me too. Maybe on the second one, I started getting a little bit itchy feet and going, oh God, it's Groundhog Day. It's the same. But you know how many people are suffering so much more. So it's, every morning I started to meditate. I've never had therapy in my life until about 8 weeks ago for the very, very first time. And she couldn't believe it. She went, you're a child actress and it's the first time you've had therapy at 44 years old. Yep. And what's made you come? I think I'm thinking too much. I'm overthinking everything. She said, well, maybe you're always on the go. You're just constantly moving. It is, and I think I was scared to stop. And I also think I wasn't really dealing with things. I'd be subconsciously pushing them somewhere and letting them come up ready for the next character. I'm thinking you have to be in a certain mindset, otherwise I won't be able to do it. Mm. I think, well, come on, Anna, after 30 years, if you haven't learned your craft, there's something quite wrong. It's more about balance and shifts.
It's no accident that I'm in an insecure profession, because there's something about its insecurity that I sort of like.
Because we are insecure.
Yeah, but also I like the fact that, you know, next week someone might give me a call and I might be over the other side of the world. I like the fact that, you know, there was one time when I knew what I was doing for the next 2.5 years and I didn't like it. And everybody else was like, that must be great to know what you're going to be doing for the next 2.5. And I was like, you know what? I don't really like it. I like the fact that I like the packed bag up in my bedroom that I might need to use any second if someone gives me the call, you know.
We're probably both scared of being bored. I think the two things that scare me most are boredom and loneliness. And you think, and it's that excitement, isn't it, of what's the new. I know I said earlier, so I'm contradicting myself, of as you get older, it's not as exciting. It's just more about the length of time and, oh, who am I going to be with, and not having Gracie. But this time I'm shooting in Sweden next. We haven't found our lead man, actually.
Hey. Well, you've got my number.
Well, yeah, it's quite a good project too, and it's a really good character. I might have to, after this there podcast, call you and say, take a look.
We'll be back with more chat after this.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, you're listening to Who Am I This Time? With me, David Morrissey. Now, back to this week's episode.
Can I ask you about watching yourself? What's that like? And have you always done it? And do you watch the monitor on set?
Again, it very much depends on who I'm working for or with. Some don't like you to go to the monitor, others do. I remember there was Jim Sheridan in Dublin years ago. I was only 23, and he'd recommended, because I was asking him about how he'd worked with Daniel Day-Lewis, as one I really admired, and he said, I really believe actors should see exactly what they're doing instead of ever you've got an audition or you're rehearsing. He said, put the camera on the mantelpiece or wherever it is that's at head height, watch what you're doing and watch it back, face yourself and see, are you communicating what you want to communicate? Now, sometimes that helps, but then as I've got older and you get more self-conscious, and I think the better you become, the less self-conscious you can be, and you know the tricks. There's some things I've done I haven't even watched. I remember a Woody Allen movie, and I was filming something in the day. I was rehearsing the play. I was at Breakfast at Tiffany's, and then Woody had called to the night before saying, there's 7 pages of dialogue. I've woken up, I've got the wrong person. Can you come and film tomorrow? And it was a scene with Antonio Banderas and Naomi Watts. And I was like, fuck, how am I going to do it? I'm already doing 2 characters. I said, can I do it in a different accent so I don't get confused? Because that would be 3 characters I'm working on. And it was, at the time, you're really proud to work with Woody Allen. But I've never watched that back. I watch things maybe once. Marcello, I watch along with the public. It was every week there was a build-up before the bin set. So I'd kind of like to see the anticipation and if there was what we used to call the water cooler talk. Mm-hmm.
Watch dailies? You never watch like rushes or anything?
If there's a problem and you need to not, people are understanding what the problem is and say, look, go and see, can you not, the tone's not similar with everybody. We're all in something different. I don't think we're set in a tone. I might ask, can I see it? But usually that takes me out. So to be honest, I don't. I stay in my head and hope for the best. But I'm a bit of a stickler for lighting, so I'd rather get it right first. And once we go, I might check something. Just, can you show me a monitor? Yeah, okay, cool. I've not got some big shadow over my face, which doesn't need to be there.
And what about, you know, you said you're an executive producer on season 3, but what, as the leading actor, What do you feel that you're in charge of? What do you feel that you're above and beyond doing your character? What do you feel that your job is?
To set a standard, to be grateful, knowing that everybody's going to be looking up to you. And if you've got a problem, then they're going to have a problem. Work ethic, always being the one to say, look, I'm willing to push on. Also, can we have a running lunch? Because we save so many hours. Because if we all go to our trailers and all eat, it slows us down in concentration. I'll always go around and be fair and say to the crew, who would like to have a 9-hour shooting day rather than the 12-hour day with an hour lunch break? That being prepared. So you set an example of always knowing your lines. I think as I was younger, I look back thinking, oh, you just had such confidence and winging it. And I think it was all to do with insecurity and fear. Totally thinking it's all going to fail, so I might as well just let it fail. I think I might have had a bit of that attitude, which is just totally different now. But I think setting a standard, understanding the other people, going to them, making them feel comfortable, knowing what it's like if you're not the lead, of the nerves that people can have if they're a day player walking in with a few, they've not got that many lines, and I can feel their nerves and I just want to go and give them a big hug and go, it's fine, come on, let's go over here, and because you want the scene to be good. And also knowing no scene is a scene if you're the only one who's good. I hate that in actors when they're selfish. It's like, well, then what do you want to say? You were good in that scene, or it was a good scene?
Sometimes I feel that day players, because people feel, they can be clock watchers and they're like, oh, come on, you've only got two lines. I think it's the hardest thing sometimes to come in maybe on a Friday afternoon and have four lines at the end of the day when everybody wants to go home. I think that's the hardest thing.
Oh, God, the nerves. And that they're going to turn the camera on them last, and they're going to, it's all going to be rushed. And you think, I don't ever want it to be like that. So it's always having empathy. But again, what I've found really helps is so that everybody feels part of it. I'll ask the director, what do you feel about, and is it possible to the sound department, can we get the music that's in my ears and I'm feeling, and if that's right for the scene, and I blast it onto the set so everyone starts to get in the mood and feel the atmosphere and we're all part of it. And it's like, come on, or if you've got one big long steady cam shot that you're going, come on, come on, don't fuck it up. So everyone's really excited when at the end, well, we did it.
That is brilliant. Now, obviously, with Marcella, you're in a team with Hans and Nicola, which you trust, and you have a dialogue with them. But sometimes we're in situations where we can rub up against the wrong person or something can happen. How do you deal with that when there's a clash, if a director or a showrunner wants you to play a role in a different way than you've conceived it? Is that something that you would go via your agent with, or would you confront that on your own, or what?
That's a good question. Prevention is cure. So you try and sort those things out before you start, so you never find yourself in a position of animosity on a public forum or stage. That's the last thing you want to happen. And I think you learn that with time, age and experience. I remember also knowing what's acceptable and what isn't. I don't really want to go into names and bring up the kind of Me Too-ish things, but if I look back, so many things were inappropriate that just would never, ever be able to happen now. And I remember one director saying, okay, do it English. Do it in your English accent. Okay, now do it American. Now do it English. And literally like a parrot. And I thought, that's really not how you attempt something. And we just kept accepting this until I realized that was really wrong. Or I had one director, he literally licked his fingers because he didn't like one hair sticking out and did this on my hair. Loads of stories of just things that are completely inappropriate. And usually I'll take them to the side and say, that's not really cool, is it? But what's hard, I think, is if someone breaks your attention and you're in such concentration in a certain mood, and you know yourself when you get that take and you know you're not going to be able to repeat it, it only happens once and the boom's in shot, or which happens and things go wrong, or someone's really giving you a different performance off camera to when it turns around, then it doesn't make your camera make your performance make sense. Those things annoy me. But I guess it's just acceptance. You breathe through it. Meditation helps. And make sure we're all on the same page before we even begin, I would say.
I think also, you know, particularly on location, particularly when you're on location, maybe in a foreign country, a film set can be quite a lonely place sometimes.
Yes.
And it's about, for me, about how I, the routine I have, my internal routine that I still find my confidence in, or I find myself in, that I can go to rather than just spin out of control, really, because sometimes I can. If I'm feeling vulnerable and sort of in the middle of nowhere or in a foreign land, or particularly if I've only just arrived. Sometimes, you know, you arrive, you're on set straight away, you're in a character. I mean, I remember doing The Walking Dead and I was on the film set and I was just, you know, I was bricking it. And I didn't know how to say to somebody, hey, you know, I'm bricking it here. Can you help me out? So I usually just, I mean, basically, I just drank loads of coffee, which didn't help at all.
Basically, it's so much worse. The elevated heart rate. I drink probably on set about 8 cups of tea a day, and I'm allowed 1 cup of coffee because it really, a coffee for me is like 5 Red Bulls. It just then the nervous energy. And I found just sometimes find the ones that you gravitate to, find those that look at vulnerability as a positive and a strength, and just say, I'm a bit frightened. What should I do? Is it just nerves? And usually as soon as you've committed those first few lines to a film, you go, oh, I've done it now. There we go. Yeah. I'm committed. I can breathe. But it's, I think if you didn't have that fear, then maybe you wouldn't be driving yourself to be good. And the wonderful thing about our job is that you can never be too good. It's not that you can get, become a CEO of a company and then buy the bank. You can't ever stop being better.
No, and I like my nerves. My nerves are, for me, a good indicator that I care.
Yes.
So, you know, I sort of like that. You said that, you know, because you started at the Oldham Theatre Workshop, and you said that the guy who ran it there was quite tough, but it gave you a resilience. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, he was a wonderful man called David Johnson. I was 13 in our school. We had a middle school system where I grew up in Rochdale, and they didn't class drama as an academic subject. So it was a wonderful teacher I had at school called Mr. Rawlins, who died a few years later. But for some reason, he saw something in me. I was only musical and was in the choir. He said, no, I think you've got a real flair for acting. I was like, really? And he sent me to this recommended Oldham Theatre Workshop, which was, at that age, quite a lot of work. So you'd be doing all your... all your schoolwork. I'm the daughter of two teachers, so that was very important that I got my grades, and I was an A student. And in the evenings, they'd drive me to Oldham, which was 30 minutes drive, and it was 6:45 to 10, 3 nights a week, and then 10 a.m. until 10 p.m. every Sunday. And it was all improvisation. But his level, he didn't care. You had children that were from incredibly poor families and hard council estates, to other kids that went to Manchester Grammar and lived in big mansions in Cheshire. So it was a huge mix of the spectrum as far as wealth is concerned and education. When you walked into that room, none of that mattered. And he was not afraid of swearing. He would be called, you little beep, what are you, beep, 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 whatever, beep. And you either were strong enough to deal with that, or you'd have certain parents that would come in and say, how dare you, how can you swear at my child? He's like, great, take your child. Have you seen how busy it is in this room? Take them. But he was so good, because he would just be completely honest and say, I don't believe you. And learning that lesson at a very young age, that's all it's about, really, is believability. Do I believe that, or can I see them acting? And then your play, and so the improvisation, you're using your English and your vocabulary, and not just, if you ever talk, you're not just saying cup of tea, coming up with the same thing. You're moving. And also it was stage. I remember my first ever line was, I'm a good girl, I am. And I had to try and do a Cockney accent at age 13 and wear a pair of heels. To this day, I still can't walk in big stilettos. I just look like the kids that put their mum's shoes on and try and walk. I mean, and they were purple patent. Oh, my God. But you automatically got an agent when you were there. And I remember going for my first audition, which they'd bring people from London to come up to the Oldham Theatre Workshop because they heard that there were these really well-trained not very expensive child actors. it was Alan Bleasdale and Michael Palin came up, and I had 5 auditions for that. And that was the first. And
that was GBH, wasn't it?
No, GBH, yeah. And my brother joined the Oldham Theatre Workshop because Big Sister did, and he ended up doing it because he was far cuter than I was. And he got all the work before me. So you didn't even want to go, Michael. I can't believe it. He's a doctor. He's the original Hovis boy that pushes the bike up the hill.
So that, I mean, I think that's great training. I really do. And it sounded, I just read a little bit about it. It's so great to hear you talk about it because it sounds very exciting and exactly what you need walking into a film set, because it is a nurturing environment, but it's also a workplace.
And it was also free. Now that makes such a big difference. So it was open. There are so many wonderful actors out there. And that's, I think, why I want to take more of the journey of producing, because I hate this circle that unless you've done these jobs, you can't get into the industry, and they haven't done it. Well, how are they ever meant to get into it? Yeah. And you've got sometimes some of the most wonderful actors as people who, how can you be a good actor if you've not lived? You're telling your stories. And some of these kids that go back to quite hard home lives, but would come in and get on a stage and wow, they were so good. And because it got them out of the house, their parents didn't have to pay for it. And if you look what's happened in the lockdown as far as actors or people in the arts are concerned, to say retrain and there's no furloughing, my heart just goes out. I've been doing quite a lot of press recently for Marcella and been asked that question, thinking, well, how can you say that the arts is not a job? What are you listening to? What are you watching when we're all here? And I think we need to take care of us more. I'd like to go to, I know David Johnson now works in Cheshire, and there isn't the Oldham Theatre Workshop as we knew it, but it's such a good way to learn about yourself, even if you don't want to be an actor, just to put yourself in other people's shoes. It'd be good to teach it more at school and get the bully to play the kind person, and vice versa.
I do think that way of honing your empathetic skills, acting, walking in somebody else's shoes is really important. And I see that a lot, whether you want to be a performer or not, just that imaginative trip is really important for us, I think.
Yeah, and for confidence, sometimes we wake up and we really don't want to go to your office job, but you've got to put a smile on your face and not say, oh, I've got really bad period pains today, or something awful happened yesterday. You've all got to put on the mask, so to speak. Mm. And so those skills will help anybody throughout their life. So I think it is a kind of lifelong ambition of mine to try and recreate Oldham Theatre Workshop, going back to Rochdale or Oldham and helping them in the same way that I was helped. Because without a doubt, if it wasn't for that place, there's no way I'd be in the situation that I'm in now.
No, I had that too at the Everyman Theatre. I had that, the youth theatre there, which was a really important period of my life. Can we just talk about theatre? Because I know, you know, you're a Broadway award-winning actress when you did Closer and stuff. Is your process different going into a theatre role than it is going into a television and film role?
Yeah. Well, because we get to rehearse, which is the joy for me. And now at most sets, you're lucky if you get a day, usually it's turn up and action. I try and insist on as much rehearsal as possible, and I offer my services for free. So the agents go, oh, you've got them for an extra 2 weeks. They say, no, I'll just, please, can we just rehearse? You don't have to pay me. And to break down a play for 3-4 months is so exciting. It's like going back to school. But I also know that you have to absolutely adore the character and adore the play, because that is difficult. You get it's fine for the first month, and you've got all those nerves getting you through, and then and do it again and do it again. And sometimes it's not about finding something new because it's entertaining to you that isn't serving the character or the audience. I don't know if I could do a 6-month run again. At the end of that, I was thought, oh, I can't do it again. But I used to do theatre every 4 years, and I saw Sean Mathias, this director I worked with, and I said, oh, yeah, it's probably about time. He said, Anna, it's not 4 years. Do you know it's nearly 7? I mean, really? Is it? Is it time to do theatre again? Now, the idea of it with all our beautiful theatres being closed, I just think it's a time to retrain, isn't it? It's a time when there's no cot. You can't go again. It's from beginning to end. You're playing in sequence. And there's also that wonderful camaraderie, isn't there? Because you're with your team players, you need them so much. If you're on stage and something's come wrong and you've got me. Oh God. And that adrenaline, it's a huge rush.
I think the fallacy though with the theatre is people think you just do it for those 2 hours in the night, whereas I wake up in the morning and I'm thinking about it. I mean, it's a 24-hour job for me when I'm in the theatre. In fact, I can switch off from my television and film much easier than I can from theatre.
Oh, me too. You know how you can do the positive affirmations when you wake up and say, well, what am I grateful for? I agree with you so much. I remember waking up and you think, oh, I've got to do it again. How, I don't feel in the right frame of mind. Oh my God. And you know that you've got until 7 o'clock, but then, because you've got to also change your sleep pattern so that your main energy is ready at seven, but then you come off, you become kind of nocturnal because at 10 o'clock you're pumping and you think, I can't go to bed now. I've got all this energy, but then you worry about not sleeping enough. It's all, it goes in a circle. I'm the same. And Patrick Marber for Closer used to say to me, he said, oh gosh, by month two, you'll be thinking about what you're shopping when you're on stage. By month six, I said, I'm still not thinking about my goddamn shopping. I said, am I going to be able to do that big breakdown and again for the number for that after all that time? Because otherwise, because you don't, I think when you know they're paying so much money to come and see you and that's the one experience, you don't want to let one person down. So there's even more of a pressure to deliver and serve.
Also, just my, you know, internal clock. I would wake up in the morning, I'd cough and think, oh, I'm not going to be able to do it tonight. I can't do it. And then the whole day with me thinking, how am I going to do it? And then I get to the theatre thinking, oh, I'm so tired. I am so tired. Yeah. And then I do a warm-up. I do the show. And then I wouldn't be able to sleep till 4 in the morning because I was full of beans.
Me too. Have you ever done it with a bad back?
Oh, I've done it with bad everything.
Yeah, I think it wasn't that. Literally, I couldn't stand up. I was bent over to this and thought, that's how can I play Holly Go Lightly like this? It's meant to be holding my head up and showing off my hat. And there was a chiropractor at the back of the well, the show must go on, or they call it, and there is, it's true, isn't it? Doctor Theatre. And he'd be at the back and go, and I had to get on and back on we go, and there we are. But I know that throat thing, you're thinking, no, it's not there. But again, this time off, the positive affirmation and what do we draw and how can we do it? And the breath, I always found that was good. I have a trick for theatre. So where's Broadway? It's the first time I'd ever been on stage, and I was only 22. And I wanted it to be as naturalistic as possible. So it was like someone coming to watch you perform on a film set. But what I couldn't overcome, and I had a brilliant teacher called Patsy Rodenberg, who was next to me every day, brilliant woman. And you take the bigger breath, but it still sounded like I was shouting all the time and I could hear myself. And then I thought, well, that's not bloody naturalistic. I'm just aiming my voice to the end, which obviously is technique. But I used a trick. I put in earplugs. So I could still obviously hear the person next to me, but I couldn't hear my own voice. It didn't sound like I was shouting, much like when people put headphones on and they say, do you like the song? I love this song. It's fantastic, this song. So it worked in that kind of vein.
That is great. I'm going to use that next time.
Honestly, really, it works. I can't believe they don't use it as an exercise for people.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
Look, there's so much I want to talk to you about, but I mean, it's Marcella, I think season three is really exciting. And but things like, you know, Butterfly, which I just thought was amazing, The Street, so much stuff. But I just wanted to wrap up with, you know, if you could look back at looking back at the girl who's starting out into this business, what would you say to her now as yourself in the position you're in now? If you could just talk to Anna when she's just starting out in this business, what advice would you give her?
Well, it's ironic because it'll probably be something to do with the job that we did together, but we didn't have many scenes or if any. But
our mutual friend.
Yeah. I loved that. I wish I'd been more prepared for that. I love period dramas and the BBC. And I don't think I'd probably gave myself my best shot on that one. I don't know. For me, I'd never been taught an RP accent, a received pronunciation. It was Joan Washington who was Richard E. Grant's wife, or maybe still is. Mm-hmm. And And I wasn't given the tools, and it was such a different world for me. And I was quite intimidated by everybody's experience. And I'd not done very much. I'd only played this one character with Brookside, and not one, I'd done GBH, but the big one, and become quite famous. And no one really helped me. And I did ask for help. I did say, I think I need a bit of help here. This is not normal. I'm not going, my life isn't normal. And I'd say I should have shouted louder, and I should have had better management. I don't think I was looked after very well. Mm-hmm. Thank God I've got great parents. And they guided me somewhat, but I'm now very, very protective of any child actor I work with, and make sure that they've been given all the necessary tools to deal with quite an odd world. But I've kept a lot of my old beliefs. I think I've hopefully kept my and held on to my integrity and for what I believe in. And my work ethic has done nothing but grow. Just sometimes give yourself a little stroke on the back and know that most of the things you worry about and are anxious about were a waste of time, and focus that energy in a very, very different way. And remember that other people are just as scared as you. We've got to talk about it sometimes a bit more, which I think we are. The whole conversation about mental health now is much easier. Yeah. And keeping that you can never be too kind.
Well, on that note, thank you very much. It's been wonderful to talk to you today. Marcella 3 is fantastic. As I said, I've only seen 2 episodes. Can't wait for the rest of it.
Oh, thanks.
But I'm really looking forward to it. Very different, but God, it was good.
I'll wait till you get to it. It gets better and better. It gets its number 6, because I didn't want the audience to be frustrated. So I got them to do an episode that takes you back of exactly what happens when she came out of the tunnel after slicing her face. And that, you see.
Great stuff. Well, it's great work. It really is. As again, so I love it.
Who Am I This Time? Is a Just Voices and Doolally production. Produced by Simon Lenigan. Music by Greg Hatlow. Edited and mixed by Russ Keffert at Audio Egg. And presented by me, David Morrissey.